from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, you know that I almost never talk about my personal life on this broadcast. This is for frying other fish. But something happened this week that I just do have to share with you because it's so wacky. I'm a connoisseur of the wacky, and when wacky happens, I'm sitting in my own backyard with a couple of writing partners because you know you write in your don't even start. There's no pool there. There's no pool in the backyard. We're just sitting for good and sufficient reasons. We're sitting in the backyard. It's warm, but it's windy. You may remember seeing on the news about the big wind last Monday. Nobody had Mexican. It was the Santa Ana winds whipped up fires in Malibu. It was on the news. You saw it. Anyway, those winds, they're a-blowing. And you know how writers are. We talk about what we're writing, and then we talk about other stuff. And then we talk about other stuff. And then we talk about maybe getting back to writing. And then we talk about other stuff. So one of us notices the palm trees out on the street and the wind and says, boy, they might be ripe for snapping. And I, waxing pretentious, say, no. You know, the palm trees are really, you have to worry about in this kind of weather, are those big 60-foot-high palms, those very thin-trunked trees in another part of town that have learned to bend into the sea wind, the ocean breeze, the ocean wind. They bend their 60-foot-high trunks into it so as to withstand the gale. And, of course, they're in for a big surprise today when the Santa Anas come from the east blowing at 60 miles. That could really snap them. And within 2 seconds after I said the word snap, a 9-foot-tall ornamental plum tree that we have in our backyard, because nothing in the heat of the summer beats the cool refreshment of an ornamental plum. An ornamental plum tree, 9-foot-tall, 10-foot-tall ornamental plum tree, snaps in a big gust of the wind, and the full weight of it, the trunk, it's pulled out of the ground, ladies and gentlemen. Think of it. And falls on the back of my neck. Yes, I was. And amazingly, almost nothing happened. Well, I mean, things happened. You know, people ran around and phone calls were made and emergency room visits were conducted and so forth. But nothing happened. Doctor I visited said, you know, I've had two patients in my 40 years of practice. Crusty old internist said, I've had two patients. You're the second patient in my 40 years of practice who's been traumatized by a tree. The first one was a young girl in a convertible. She didn't make it. All right, then. So, ladies and gentlemen, at times like these, you know, it's natural, it's unavoidable that you do some reassessment, take some inventory, look at things a new way. I now realize that I've officially surpassed Gavin McLeod and Anson Williams. I am now officially the luckiest man in show business. Hello, welcome to the show.
In the event of something happening to me, there is something I would like you all to see. It's just a photograph of someone that I knew. Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide, Mr. Jones. I keep straining my ears to hear a sound. Maybe someone is digging underground. Or have they given up and all gone home to bed, thinking those who once existed must be dead? Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide, Mr. Jones. In the event of something happening to me, there is something I would like you all to see. It's just a photograph of someone that I knew. Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide, Mr. Jones.
Full of 35 kids, I gotta go for a Sunday drive. Sunday. Big city taking a nap. Slow down, it's Sunday. Life's a ball, let it fall right in your lap. If you've got troubles, just take them out for a walk. They'll burst like bubbles in the fun of a Sunday in New York. You can spend time without spending a dime, watching people watch people pass. Later you pause, and in one of the stores there's that face next to yours in the glass. Two hearts stop beating, you're both too breathless to speak. Love smiles her greeting, then the dream that has seen you through the week comes true on Sunday in New York. So you can take a short nautical break. They've got boats by the lake for hire. If there's a storm, you just make it on home and get cozy and warm by a fire. By Monday morning, you're both agreed it was fate. As day comes dawning, if you can't pick the spot or set the date, you met on Sunday, New York on Sunday. So make it Sunday in New York.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, walking and talking, just like I used to be, welcoming you to another edition of Le Show. Sunday in New York, of course, reminds me to thank the New York Times for a lovely, lovely thing in the arts and leisure section. Just, you know, it was worth cutting all those trees this week. And in the Close Enough for Journalism file, which is, of course, our new feature here on the broadcast, always new features here on the broadcast, just to enhance your view, your perception of the value of the broadcast. Close Enough for Journalism. On the Fox News Channel. Now, wait. Announcing the death of Morris Gibb of the Bee Gees on Sunday morning, about 9:30 Pacific time, the newsreader said, the Bee Gees skyrocketed to fame in 1977 with the soundtrack for Saturday Night Fever. So I guess the group that did New York Mining Disaster and in the 60s, really was the Beatles, as the rumors had it back then. Close, you know, a decade. What's a decade among news channels? Hear it, ladies and gentlemen. Talk about burying the lead, which is another of our features. You know, there's really going to be very little time left for filling time if I keep adding features. Burying the lead is, in the news business, is means putting the most important item in the story way down. Maybe after you've had to turn the page, the jump. But it's way down, when it should be, of course, by accepted journalistic principles, right there in the first paragraph. Well, how about this? This is a story. I hesitate to say, because when I printed it out from my computer, I did not include the newspaper it's from. It's by David K. Johnston, if that's a clue. And it's a story about a group that has been promoting income tax evasion, basically saying you don't have to pay taxes because Section 816 of the Internal Revenue Law, it's a wacky, or let's say a differing interpretation of Section 816. And a judge said it was wacky and illegal and ordered the group in question to stop promoting tax evasion. That's the lead. Here's what's buried way down in the story. Federal Judge Christopher C. Connor wrote in rejecting Thurston Paul Bell, the defendant's argument that he was protected by the First Amendment in saying you didn't have to pay your taxes. Quote, although the First Amendment protects commercial speech generally, it does not protect false commercial speech. Unquote. Federal Judge Christopher C. Connor. If that isn't the lead, if that doesn't make, certain tobacco companies and other firms quake in their boots, repeating, although the First Amendment protects commercial speech generally, it does not protect false commercial speech. I'm just listening to the Blackberries buzzing with all the meetings scheduled for tomorrow about those new commercials. Let's do a rethink. Here are two items to add to your just to your collection of perspectives about this Iraq deal. This is from the conservative British newspaper, The Telegraph. Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, has been warned by his cabinet ministers that he must take urgent steps to sell, in quotes, his military strategy on Iraq as he faces the threat of rebellion from members of his own party. The Prime Minister is being urged to, quote, hit the road, unquote, and undertake a nationwide tour explaining the need for military action to counter the growing threat of mass defections from party activists. Thank God they don't need to do that in this country. This stark message was delivered to the Prime Minister last week by three of his most intimate allies in the cabinet. They warned the scale of the revolt facing Mr. Blair was surprising and shocking. The newspaper also surveyed Labour Party officials and suggested that thousands of members will quit the party if Britain invades Iraq without a specific UN mandate. So he'll hit the road to sell the policy over there, and we can just watch. Meanwhile, in Sunday's Washington Post, we learn on September 17th, 2001, 6 days after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, President Bush signed a two-and-a-half-page document marked Top Secret that outlined the plan for going to war in Afghanistan as part of a global campaign against terrorism. Almost as a footnote, the document also directed the Pentagon to begin planning military options for an invasion of Iraq, according to senior administration officials. 6 days after 9/11. The previously undisclosed Iraq directive is characteristic, says the Washington Post, of an internal decision-making process that has been obscured from public view over the next 9 months. The administration would make Iraq the central focus of its war on terrorism without producing a paper trail or record of key meetings and events, leading to a formal decision to act against Saddam Hussein. Instead, according to this administration decision-making participants, the decision to confront Hussein at this time emerged in an ad hoc fashion. Often, the process circumvented traditional policymaking channels, as longtime advocates of ousting Hussein, like Paul Wolfowitz, pushed Iraq to the top of the agenda by connecting their cause to the war on terrorism. The results of this murky process continue to reverberate today. Tepid support for military action at the State Department, muted concern in the military ranks of the Pentagon, and general confusion among relatively senior officials about how or even when the policy was decided. In July of last year, 2002, the State Department's Director of Policy Planning, Richard Haass, held a regular meeting with Condi Rice and asked whether they should talk about the pros and cons of confronting Iraq. This is last July. Don't bother, Rice replied. The decision has already been made. That was before August when we were told the president hasn't made a decision yet, and Andrew Card said, you don't introduce a new product before Labor Day. Ladies and gentlemen, I think enough time has passed where we have to get to another regular feature. Yes, it has. The Apologies of the Week.
We're so
sorry. Few apologies this week. Not a big week for apology. Germany's television license. You know, in most countries, they collect a license fee from citizens for state-run television like the BBC. Germany's television license fee agency apologized this week for sending an angry letter demanding payment from an 8th century saint, says Eckhard Olliger, an official at the Cologne-based GEZ fee collection headquarters, which collects $6.8 billion per year from viewers. This was quite embarrassing, but unfortunately mistakes happen. Father Karl Terhorst said the agency had sent letters demanding payment of the monthly $16 fee to a woman named Frau Walburga Saint at the address of the Roman Catholic Church in Ramsdorf, 80 miles east of Cologne. At first, I just ignored the letters, Terhorst said, but after the last letter demanding payment threatened the saint with legal action and a 1,000 euro fine, I figured it was time to write back. Terhorst informed the collection agency that Saint Walburga, born in 710 in England, was an abbess and missionary who played an important role in Saint Boniface's organization of the Frankish Church. She headed a monastery and was made a saint in 880. She still could be watching TV, in which case she owes the... American satirist Michael Moore stormed out of Britain after a bust-up with the London Theatre hosting his one-man show. The Bowling for Columbine movie maker performed Michael Moore live to packed audiences for 2 months before Christmas at the Roundhouse in North London. On the penultimate night, he reportedly flew into a rage, verbally attacking everyone associated with the production because he thought he wasn't being paid enough. During the performance, he complained he was making just $750 a night. A member of the stage crew says, quote, he completely lost the plot. He stormed around all day, screaming at everyone, even the £5-an-hour bar staff, telling them how we were all common and useless. Then he went on stage and did it in public. Staff retaliated by refusing to work the following night, which led to the show being held up for an hour. Eventually, Moore made a groveling apology to staff, and the angry audience finally took their seats. Source reports Moore packed his bags and flew to New York the next day. And Dateline Los Angeles, Marvin Davis may be a big-time Hollywood mogul, but physically he's not that big, as even rival media kingpin Barry Diller admitted this week after apologizing for calling Marvin Davis fat. Davis has offered $15 billion to acquire the entertainment assets of Vivendi Universal, which Diller heads up. Diller reportedly has his own ambitions for the units, which include Universal Studios, the USA and Sci-Fi cable TV channels, and Universal theme parks. On Tuesday at an investor conference in Southern California, Diller discussed both possibilities. He said one option was that, quote, that fat Marvin Davis or some other reputable player comes along and buys it. By Wednesday, the fat comment was making headlines and Diller apologized. For my stupid and cheesy attempt at humor at the end of a luncheon interview, I apologize, he said in a statement. It was ungracious, uncalled for, and inaccurate. Spokesman for Davis declined to comment. Davis, 77, had been overweight for some time, but sources who know him said he has lost 130 pounds in recent months. The Marvin Davis diet! In the 1980s, Davis hired Diller to run 20th Century Fox. But the two clashed until Davis sold Fox to Rupert Murdoch. Those are the apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Marvin Davis, I think, showing remarkable restraint under the circumstances. But that's just me. And for something to be scared about, oh, that is a copyrighted feature, isn't it? Yeah. No, I don't know if it is. Yes, it is. Turns out it is.
Let's get scared. Let's get scared.
This week's scary story from the British Sunday Press reveals something I didn't know, which is always good. There are plans to pump vast quantities of iron into the world's oceans in a bid to reduce carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. Did you know that these plans existed? It's a project backed by U.S. businessmen and researchers to seed the seas with iron. It could trigger a global ecological disaster, according to scientists, leading to the uncontrollable spread of toxic algae and the release of gases that could damage the Earth's ozone layer. Professor Sally Chisholm, a marine biologist at MIT, told the British Sunday Observer, it would be folly on a global scale. She was backed by Professor Andrew Watson of East Anglia University. It's not just that this project may be dangerous, it is also unethical, he said. What right has one group or country to use the world's oceans to resolve its domestic problems? The scheme is based on the discovery that tiny amounts of iron, one part per billion, are critical in stimulating phytoplankton growth in seas. As such, plankton absorb carbon dioxide. Proponents argue that increased iron and plankton levels would lead to the removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, helping to slow down global warming. In many parts of the world, iron in seawater is virtually non-existent and plankton levels correspondingly low. As a result, several groups of U.S. entrepreneurs, including Planktos, backed by Neil Young, have begun experiments aimed at correcting this problem by pumping tons of soluble iron compounds into the seas. He provided his yacht, Ragland, free of charge, to Planktos trials off the coast of Hawaii. Tons of iron were dumped overboard and the growth of plankton measured. The results have encouraged Planktos, which is funded by donations from U.S. energy companies and other groups, to consider selling their services. They hope to charge the U.S. government around $10 for each ton of carbon that they remove from the atmosphere. This would allow America to reduce the carbon emission cutbacks that it will have to make if it ever signs the Kyoto Agreement on global warming. Global warming. In other words, by interfering with the world's oceans, the U.S. will be able to maintain its high output of industrial gases. Says Dr. Lee Rice of Green Sea Venture, one of the other firms involved, there's no law or international agreement that prevents us from doing this. It is perfectly legal. Plankton would bloom and then die, sinking to the seabed, carrying with them the carbon dioxide they had absorbed. We would only do our seeding episodically, say for 30-day periods, says one of the officials involved, so as not to trigger other undue environmental side effects. We will then charge for our services. This concept was derided by scientist Chisholm. You can certainly measure how much plankton growth you've stimulated, but that will not tell you how much carbon will have sunk to the seabed. Much of it could simply be released back into the atmosphere. All right, then. I'll be scared of that. Are you satisfied now?
If I had my way, I'd never see light of day. I never opened up my eyes until the sun was gone. I'd be the king vampire of the street that empire, and I wouldn't lay down my head until the crack of dawn. I'd raise my cigarette downtown, spread my money all around. I'd knock the eight ball in on the break. I'd take a night of scotch, look down at my watch, and it says so many people you don't want to see, and none of them awake. I'd dance the daytime women until their heads would swim, and then maybe take home two or three. If I had my way, I'd never see the light of day, and the sunshine would never shine on me. My cigarette downtown, spread my money all around. I knocked the eight ball in on the break. I'd take a knock of scotch as I looked down at my watch, and it'd say, so many people you don't want to see, and ain't none of them awake. I'd dance the daytime women until their heads were swimming, and then maybe take home two or three.
sunshine would ever shine on me. Please don't keep shining your light. Sunshine would never shine on me.
Picking the winners before the horses leave the starting gate.
It's our first annual preview of the year ahead in entertainment.
Gotta be extra access tonight for the early middle of January 2003. Hi, everybody. I'm Pat Mungo.
And I'm Mike DeVere. 2002 is an entertainment year to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And 2003 promises more of the same.
So, welcome aboard for our first annual look ahead at the stories we'll be looking back at less than a year from now.
In movies, we'll see I Did Your Mama, the motion picture debut of rapper Ice Trey. And July 4th weekend, we'll rock to the $200 million super animated spectacle based on the classic video game Pong.
But comedy fans will be marking their calendars for the latest Gaylord Spinks hit, Boob Job. Gaylord explained the premise to us while taking a break from shooting the trailer.
There's this cop, right? And he's so dumb that they convince him that to work undercover as a woman, he has to get big old breast implants, and then he busts some big-time crack dealers, right?
Boob Job will be busting out this June.
Television has never been so real. And in 2003, reality television is kicking it up a notch. Premiering this spring is Joe Pervert, where a small town is filmed after being told that a child molester has just moved in. Actor Crosby Nash plays the fake new neighbor.
It's very wild, really. Each week, a different family was secretly paid by the producers to pretend to be victimized by me. By about the third week, nobody in town would sell me food. And it gets wilder from there.
Also coming up in the spring sweeps, Fox's new reality hit, The Drink Olympics. Teams of young men competing in physical challenges while getting ever drunker. But none of them drives home.
And the new hot magazine for 2003 is the latest by legendary editor Lainey Trott. It's a glossy, gabby, glitzy magazine called Wank. And we caught up with Lainey Trott just long enough for her to explain it.
It's not a sex magazine. It's a sexy magazine. It's about everything we lust after, whether it's people or machines or ideas. It's going to bring out the post-adolescent boy in all of us. As for the title, I just bought the old swank and then figured out which letter to drop. It's very hot.
Wank will hit the stands just after Labor Day.
Well, looks like 2003 is going to be a very hot year.
Mm-hmm. Talk about global warming.
That's it for today, but Extra Access Tonight comes rolling back tomorrow with the results of our latest EAT poll.
We ask, has movie popcorn gotten better or worse? And the answers will have you reaching for a beverage.
Till then, I'm Pat Mungo.
And I'm Mike DeVere.
Saying so long from Culver City.
Say that thing and I start feeling really bad. Funny how I can do that thing and you turn certifiably mad. Well, men and women, boys and girls, we're like two types of monkeys from two separate worlds. It's alpha, it's beta, and sex is the sweetener. And sometimes I'd rather be walking the dog. I'd rather be walking. Think we ever will. I'd rather be walking the dog. Come on for a walk, doggy. Funny how when I'm acting acting sexy, you think I'm just acting strange. Funny how when you're being boyish, I'm embarrassed because you look half deranged. Well, a woman and men, jokers and fools, we're playing a game using different rules. It's alpha, it's beta, and sex is the teaser. And sometimes I'd rather be walking the dog. I'd rather be walking. Think we ever will. I'd rather be walking the dog. Yeah. Listen to me, darling. Woman and man, again and again. Look for love and for laughter when it's sex they're really after. So don't be afraid. Go on back to your. If you don't want to mourn me, darling, don't call me. I'd rather be walking the dog. I'd rather be walking the dog. 'Cause we don't understand each other, and I don't think we ever will. I'd rather be walking. Woman and man, we are just woman and man, and we'd rather be walking the dog.
Ladies and gentlemen, UN Weapons Inspection Chief Hans Blix. Okay, everybody, Hans Blix said this week that the inspectors have thus far discovered no smoking gun. I always wish I had a no-smoking gun. Just go into a place where people were smoking. Okay, everybody, put them down. No, no smoking gun. Not a no-smoking gun. No smoking gun, if you see what I'm saying. No evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, that is to say. Yet, they're working against a January 27th deadline. They're increasing the tempo of their inspections. And meanwhile, administration officials are beginning the drumbeat of, well, we never expected. You can't prove a negative. You can't. But the spotlight inexorably shifted this week to North Korea, which, after having announced it was restarting up its plutonium enrichment plan, unlike President Bush, who is just starting up his dividend recipients enrichment plan, they're enriching plutonium over there, you see. This week also announced that they were leaving the Non-Proliferation Treaty. See, I could pronounce that better before the tree hit me. No, I couldn't. That's the sad truth. This is all coming from Kim Jong-il, the secretive dictator, secretive and diminutive dictator of North Korea, who is believed to have a fondness for watching, is it Looney Tunes cartoons? No, Daffy Duck specifically. Yeah. Who was supposedly insulted when Bob Woodward's new book about Bush at War came out, and in it there's a Woodward taped George W. Bush saying at one point of Kim Jong-il, calling him a pygmy and saying, "I loathe him." Kim Jong-il is 5'3". He's no Yao Ming, if that's what you mean. So he's apparently, Kim Jong-il is perhaps upset about that. Maybe not. Maybe he's just upset, period. Anyway, it's not a crisis. Colin Powell keeps saying it's not a crisis. Former Energy Secretary Bill Richardson had a confab with the North Koreans over the weekend in New Mexico. And there may be talks. There may not be talks. It's a situation that may... Well, I'll tell you who probably is talking is... 41 and 43.
Yellow.
Hey, 41, let me ask you a question here.
Yeah.
Just how crazy do you think
dwarfy boy is anyway.
Just a second. Things so rough there that you got no time for hello, how are you?
Yeah, pretty.
How's Bar? How's Jeb, sort of?
Pretty flaking rough, yes, sir. You know, if I had a dollar for every political expert around here who told me it was a great idea to let Bob Woodward come in and tape me,
you'd have a dollar. Who else besides Carl Rove sold you that bag full of horse pucky?
No, you're right. Yeah. And then like some idiot on one of those reality shows, you know, I forget he's taping and called Dwarfy Boy a loathsome pygmy.
Dwarfy Boy?
King Jong Il. Mm. King Jong makes me ill. That's how I remember it.
Well, now, no, Rumsfeld's feeling like he's got to keep fighting for control of the Iraq account.
Yeah.
But this Korea thing,
yeah.
This really belongs in Colin's shop, doesn't it?
Let me tell you something, 41. If I thought when I was running for presidency that the reward at the end of the process was to carry out the advice of some State Department policy pansies, I'd have let Jeb take it like we originally...
Mr. Kim sees you pretending to be crazy and getting away with it. Monkey see?
Yeah, I see. But that's the question, isn't it? Is he crazy enough to pretend to be crazy with the world's number one country?
Yeah.
Or is he pretending to be crazy because he's really crazy? I mean, it's a real hobnobber's choice.
Yeah, well, don't forget your orientation, Camp. The Asian cultures value above everything else face. Just saying that state understands how to...
But see, that's just it. You let them run the show, there goes your moral clarity. Right down the old poop chute.
Moral clarity. Look here, 43, you got a two-war force deployment strategy and a three-war real-world type reality. Moral clarity is all very well and good when you're dicking around with a farm bill, but this is about the reputations of some very serious people.
Yeah. Three wars.
Yeah. Georgie Three Wars. That's going to be your gangland name. George W. Georgie Three Wars Bush. Maybe the W after the gangland name.
Are you finished? Look, the whole existence of the North Korea problem, Dwarfy Boy acting up right now, that screws up the moral clarity of the Iraq enterprise. I mean, you know and I know why we got to go Rumsfeld with Saddam and Colin with Dwarfy, but to Mr. and Mrs. Texas Ranger merchandise consumer, it doesn't make any more sense than evolution.
Listen here, 43.
Yeah.
No, you didn't ask me, but politically you're pretty well covered on the Iraq deal. As long as the opposition to the policy is being spearheaded by Barbara Streisand. She's the only prominent Democrat too arrogant to be scared of you.
Yeah.
So,
but looking at the innards of the polls...
Internals of the polls.
Yeah, right. Carl thinks support for the Iraq enterprise is broad... but thin, you know.
Well,
of course, Carl thought letting Woodward in was a grand slam.
Main thing is to stay the diplomatic course.
Yeah.
You know, it's like playing tug of war with a Rottweiler.
Yeah, that's fun, too.
He'll pull you very strongly in a bunch of different directions before his pride allows him to give you the ball.
If that's what he's holding on to.
Right.
You know, I was asking Condi this yesterday morning.
Yeah.
Who gets helped the most by Kim Jong-il's misbehaviorizing?
Well, China, of course. I mean, this is a totally unearned gift of leverage to Jiang Zemin.
Will you get your head out of China? Saddam's the guy who gets helped the most because we're distracted. I mean, we're not distracted, but we got a three-war thing and a two-war thing, like you said.
Right.
So doesn't it make sense that our friend Mr. Hussein might have had, as the diplomats say, a mutually satisfying exchange of views with Dwarfy Boy?
Don't think the diplomats say Dwarfy Boy.
All right, but follow this lead. I'm going somewhere with this.
Right.
If Saddam's the guy who put DB up to this, then the way to deal with the North Korea situation is to increase the pressure on Mr. Hussein, make Saddam sneeze, and Dwarfy Boy gets a cold tablet.
Well...
you know, if we turn out to be wrong and Kim Cherie is freelancing, at least we'll know that for sure.
Might be too late. No, you didn't ask me, but...
you know, don't keep saying that, because by the very act of calling you, I'm asking you, and I
don't have to ask you explicitly. Well, probably not telling you anything Colin isn't. Yeah. Better not be. But think North Korea's got to be dealt with as a separate account.
Yeah, well...
You know, the trick now is you got three balls in the air, and you got to keep your eye on each of them. So maybe my gangland name will be Georgie Three Balls? Yeah, maybe. You take care, Sprout.
Yeah.
This isn't Democrats you're dealing with here.
I know it. And 41?
Yeah.
If Woodward calls, don't talk to him.
You got it. Love to Laura.
Mine too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ooh, stop shaking, boy. Unless you want to shake with us. Relax, you ain't breakfast. Don't let us bug ya. We just be having fun. Don't let us bug ya.
Ladies and gentlemen, the big media news this week was in rapid succession, the ouster of Tommy...
Very devilish.
...Mottola as chief of Sony Music in this country. You may remember last summer Michael Jackson held a news conference at which he denounced Tommy Mottola as...
Very, very, very devilish.
And after a couple of days... The announcement that he was to be replaced by, of all people, Andrew Lack, the head of NBC, who had risen to the top of that organization as basically his claim to fame was running NBC News. And basically, I guess, teaching Tom Brokaw to say the word tonight 15 times a broadcast, because that's... You know, that's my theory is how it became number one. Anyway, Andy Lack, who became president of NBC a couple years ago, and now he's going to run Sony Music. And a lot of people, a lot of the know-it-alls in the record industry who, you know why they're not selling CDs anymore, for example, are opining that it's a strange choice because it's not a good thing, they say. It's a clannish world, you know, and they don't look kindly on not appointing a record man to run a record company. However, they ignore... the recent past at NBC, which has been, if anything, rife with records.
From NBC Tel Records comes the next great CD soundtrack of one of your all-time favorite TV shows. The first ever full-length CD featuring Tom Brokaw, the NBC Nightly News, singing songs in the key of L.
Laurel Canyon Boulevard, Larchmont Boulevard, I love L.A. I think most people who watch nightly news don't even know that I sing. And yet, it's something I do during each broadcast, you know, between stories, just to keep myself alert.
Layla, you've got me on my knees, Layla.
We've brought you musical highlights from your favorite TV movies and shows. Now, for the first time, musical highlights that you've never enjoyed till now.
Isn't she lovely? Isn't she lovely tonight? If you like ukulele lady, ukulele lady like you.
My musical taste, I guess, is a lot like my news sense. All over the map.
Love me or leave me, or let me be lonely. You won't believe me, but I love you only. I'd rather be lonely than happy with somebody else.
Songs in the Key of L is not sold in any store, except the NBC stores, and even there it's often not available. So order now, and have the musical stylings of America's most watched news anchor to enjoy before or after the NBC Nightly News.
Lola, 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 L-O-L-A, Lola. Lay, lady, lay. Lay across my big brass bed, lady.
Call 1-866-NBC-TIE-IN. That's 1-866-NBC-TIE-IN. To order Tom Brokaw's Songs in the Key of L. Or for even more delays, go online at NBCTVmusic.com/Brokaw/HTML.
The thing is, I never get to say to the Nightly News audience, now I get to say to you, the paying customer.
La 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 means I love you.
Songs in the Key of L from NBC Tel Records. It's must buy music.
Remember me. I taught you to kiss. Remember me. I taught you to smile. Who broke your heart right from the start? Do you remember me? Remember me. I made you dream. Remember me with such cruel schemes. Who made you cry till you wanted to die? Do you remember me? And then one day I let you go. But how was I? Girl, I needed you so desperately. Do you remember me? Now that you've gone with somebody new, and I'm all alone, just thinking about you. Touches your lips like I used to do. Do you
thank you.
your lips like I used to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via shortwave at WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz, across North America via Sirius Satellite Radio, and around the world, whenever you want it, on your computer at two different locations, www.harryshearer.com and www.kcrw.com. And it would be just like me falling on a tree if it agreed to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail at interworld.net. That's L-E-M-A-I-L at interworld.net. That's also the address to sign up for our free weekly email newsletter. It's spam. Who cares? And here's the deal, Barry Diller. You give up stupid and cheesy attempts at humor, and I'll give up my stupid and cheesy attempts to conglomeratize the entertainment business. Deal? Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.